topic for this evening's discussion is the fourth foundation of mindfulness, Dhammanupassana, particularly the first part of it, which is the five aggregates. Excuse me, the five hindrances. Five hindrances. Before I talk about the hindrances, I want to talk about Dhammanupassana, that term. When we talk about Dhamma, there are two different renderings of it. One of them is what we could call small d Dhamma, which is really what Dhammanupassana is focused on. And that basically is the phenomena that we experience subjectively, creates a sense of self. The big D Dharma is the system that we call Buddhism, the teaching. In a way, you could say that small D Dharma in Dhammanupassana is the doorway into capital D Dharma, the process of awakening. The other three foundations, mindfulness of the body, which is called Kaya Nupassana, mindfulness of feelings, which is Veda Nupassana, and mindfulness of the mind, which is Chitta Nupassana. These are topics that were reviewed in previous talks. They are all channeled through Dhammanupassana. Everything we experience, whether it's a sensation in the body or an emotion or whatever, all of it is fabricated through the actions of what's called Dhammanupassana, or the investigation of that, excuse me. Traditionally, it's considered to be mindfulness of mental objects. But those of you who have studied with me know that one of my primary resources, research, is Anallo, Bhikkhu Anallo, and his book Satipatthana, The Direct Path to Realization, I think is becoming or has become a kind of a classic reference in Buddhism. So he expands on this notion, Dhamma, and the book, and I'm going to read the quote that illustrates that. The Pali term Dhamma can assume a variety of meanings depending on the context in which it occurs. Most translators take the term Dhammas in the Satipatthana Sutta to mean mental objects, in the sense of whatever can become an object of the mind, in contradistinction to the objects of the other five senses. In regard to Satipatthana, however, this rendering appears strange. If the term Dhammas were to refer to objects of the mind, then the other three Satipatthana should also be included here, since they, too, can become objects of the mind. However, one of the exercises listed under the fourth Satipatthana is contemplation of the six senses, together with their respective objects. So this contemplation of Dhammas is not confined to the objects of the mind as the sixth sense only. In fact, the Dhammas listed in the fourth Satipatthana, such as the hindrances and the aggregates, etc., do not naturally evoke the classification mental objects. What this Satipatthana is actually concerned with are specific mental qualities, such as the five hindrances and the seven awakening factors, and analyses of experience into specific categories, such as the five aggregates, the six sense spheres, and the four noble truths. These mental factors and categories constitute central aspects of the Buddha's way of teaching, the Dhamma, that's with a capital D. These classificatory schemes are not in themselves the objects of meditation, but constitute frameworks or points of reference to be applied during contemplation. During actual practice, one is to look at whatever is experienced in terms of these Dhammas. Thus, The Dhammas mentioned in this Satipatthana are not mental objects, but are applied to whatever becomes an object of the mind or of any other sense door during contemplation. Now, those other categories that were mentioned, the five aggregates, six sense spheres, four noble truths, seven awakening factors, so forth and so on, they'll be reviewed in future talks. But I think what he's saying there is it's important to understand that how we are framing what we are observing with mindfulness is key. There's a refrain in the each of the four foundations that talks about noticing the conditions that are triggering those particular phenomena and their transient nature and how they tend to dissipate or transition into another focus over and over and over again, the notion of anicca, of impermanence. And when we're talking about this notion of objects, it makes it seem like they are things, stationary. They're not. They're phenomena. And that's the preference that I have. I like to use, render the term dhammas as mental phenomena. Now, when the Buddha was growing up, when he was Siddhartha, the term Dharma had been around for centuries. And what it really meant to was to pay attention to how the Vedas, the Vedic lore, directed one to live a virtuous life. And that meant living in certain classes, which became castes later on, but also to follow certain rites and rituals. And so that's what the Dharma was, rites and rituals and social norms. And he changed that. What he was talking about was living basically a life that is harmless, compassionate, generous, and detached from craving and clinging. That's what the Dharma, capital D Dharma, represents. Now, the word nupassana, it's a derivative of vipassana, or insight. And this insight is not conceptual so much as it is subjective. What I mean by that is we first start out understanding the Dhammas conceptually. We read about them, we hear about them, we think about them. But what this really is about is direct knowledge of how they are manifesting in an ongoing way. That's what vipassana is. So Dhamma nupassana involves this direct subjective insight into the process of self-creation. Here's the quote from the actual sutta that describes the five hindrances, a part on five hindrances. And how, bhikkhus, does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind objects as mind objects? Here, a bhikkhu abides contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the five hindrances. And how does a bhikkhu abide contemplating mind objects as mind objects in terms of the five hindrances? Here, there being sensual desire in him, a bhikkhu understands, there is sensual desire in me. Or, there being no sensual desire in him, he understands there's no sensual desire in me. And he also understands how there comes to be the arising of unarisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the abandonment of arisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the abandonment of He also understands how there comes to be the arising of unarisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the abandonment of unarisen sensual desire, and how there comes to be the abandonment of arisen sensual desire, and there comes to be the future non-arising of abandoned sensual desire. Then it goes on to use the same formula regarding aversion and ill will, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and skeptical doubt. So that's what the gist of this particular conceptual focus involves, is how it works, is to notice what triggers a particular view or sense of self in the context of the five hindrances. So now I want to talk about the hindrances, first of all, generally as a concept, and then more specifically about each one of them and how we can cultivate ways to overcome them. First of all, they're called pancha nivarana. The word, first of all, pancha means five. Nivarana is translated as an obstacle, a hindrance, only as it applies to obstacles in an ethical sense. This is a quote from the Polytech Society Dictionary, which is sort of the premium, one of the premium books about the Pali language. So, this notion of ethics, I touched on it briefly a moment ago in terms of harmlessness, compassion, generosity, and the ability to observe with some degree of dispassion how the sense of self is being formed. As I also mentioned previously, one salvation in the Vedic world that he grew up in, it depended on conforming to the will of the gods. And he said, no, it is about how you yourself is created, your self-experience. Now, this does not mean that he denied the existence of the gods. In fact, he was quite clear about that in several different teachings. What he was saying was, if you focus on your own salvation in terms of its relevance to some kind of God figure, you're missing the point. What we're trying to do with this practice is understand how the sense of self is experienced, either in a context of liberation or in the context of salvation from dukkha. And the way I describe dukkha is traditionally it's suffering, but I prefer distress and confusion, because that really targets what we're trying to practice here, and this is relevant to the notion of the hindrances. Distress is any kind of emotional upheaval. It could either be pleasant, which would be sense desire, or unpleasant, which would be aversion, ill will, or restlessness and worry, skeptical doubt, or sloth and torpor. So that's the distress part. The confusion part is a misunderstanding, a fundamental misunderstanding of how a self is formed. And what forms a self are these certain characteristics which are instinctual. All organic beings are subject to this. One of them, in terms of they're called the three poisons, in terms of Buddhist psychology. First one is called lobha, which is desire. The second one is dosa, which is aversion. And moha, which is ignorance or delusion. So I was just talking about that in terms of distress and confusion. Now, I've talked about this so many times, but I think it's important to understand it conceptually, but even more important to directly investigate the experience of distress, the physical tension, the emotional urgency, the orientation of the mind, and so forth and so on. And the confusion part is to be really clear, directly aware of how the internal commentary that we call a self occurs, how it comes to be, what triggers it, how it manifests, and how it fades away. Very important. That will overcome the delusional part or the confusion part. So this experience of distress and confusion, one of the similes that's used is of a pond when it comes to the five hindrances, and I'll be talking about that when I talk about each one of the hindrances. But there's a core simile that is actually the title of a book about the teachings of Ajahn Chah, very famous Thai meditation master. The book is called Still Forest Pool. It's one of the first Dharma books I ever read. It's a great resource. You can actually download a free PDF version of it online. Still Forest Pool. The simile goes like this. If you are sitting around the rim of a pool in the forest and you're very, very still, that's like the mind. The surface of the pond becomes very stable, no ripples, no movement. And the way the simile goes, when you're there and you're very quiet, all kinds of strange and wonderful creatures will come to drink there. Strange and wonderful creatures are the self experiences, particularly in the context of the talk tonight, the hindrances. So if you can imagine a pond, if anything disturbs the pond, something comes up from underwater, creates a ripple. Something drops into it from trees and so forth, or rain from the sky, creates a ripple. The more you can cultivate that stillness in the mind, which is what we call samadhi paucity. Samadhi is a kind of a unification or stability of attention, and paucity is a tranquility, serenity. That creates the conditions that are most suitable for Dhamma Nupassana. In other words, you're able to notice what precipitates a ripple, a triggering event, and the configuration of the ripple, where it's located in the pond, and how big the ripples are, and so forth and so on. And you can also notice that it subsides. Ripple goes away. So that's really a great way to understand what we're practicing here. So another way to think about dealing with the hindrances, and really setting aside the hindrances is what makes the pond still. But then the conflict there, the seeming paradox is, first you want to still the mind, and then you want to explore what disturbs the stillness. So you want to cause the hindrances to subside, samadhi paucity, but then you want to notice how they are triggered, how they are experienced, and how they go away. And there's certain procedural things that you can do, I'll be talking about that, to foster that going away. And as that is accomplished, as that process is mastered, then what comes from that is not just the notion of how hindrances are formed, but also how the five aggregates operate, how the six sense bases operate, and how the seven awakening factors operate. And that's really what this is all about, is cultivating the seven awakening factors. Seven awakening factors are not about ripples. Seven awakening factors actually foster complete liberation from any kind of identification that those ripples are self. And of course, that leads finally to direct understanding of the Four Noble Truths. So that seems like a paradox, but it's not really. Another simile that the Buddha used said that when you're cultivating samadhi paucity, it's like weeding a garden, that you go and you chop down the weeds, ground is clear, but because the roots are still there, the weeds crop up again. So dhammanupassana is actually digging up the roots. What roots? Of loba, dosa, and moha. So that's what we're practicing with our mindfulness of breathing meditation, and trying to integrate that into our daily life routine. The other thing that I want to emphasize too, this isn't just about, and I'm kind of revisiting this whole notion of the ripple effect, it's not just about setting aside the hindrances. It's also about learning how to cultivate viraga, which is dispassion. And dispassion doesn't mean being emotionally flat. What it does mean, though, is, you know, when I say flat, I mean numb, unappreciative of life. Viraga means that there's an experience of a feeling of urgency, but it's not identified as a self or as requiring action. That's an important thing that we're doing, because when we're letting go of the hindrances, we're also learning how to let go of the subject-object duality. This is something that really is the culmination of the seven awakening factors. The core part of this understanding of the hindrances is that there is a self that is subjected to a hindrance, or observing of a hindrance, or even observing of letting go of a hindrance. So there's that duality. There's the observer and that which is observed. or the stimulus and the experiencer of the stimulus. And what we're trying to cultivate with this ultimately, and this is what leads to awakening, is a very clear understanding that there really is no observing self. That nature is playing out, and part of how nature plays out is through the experience of the self. I've said this a lot lately because it just keeps being more and more clear to me. You know, the function of the heart is to move blood around the body. Function of the lungs is to foster the exchange of gases into and out of the body. Function of the brain is to think and act. So that's a phenomena of nature, but we make a self out of it. Now, once it's experienced as the sense of cognition is experienced as a phenomena of nature, back again to Dhamma Nupassana, mindfulness of mental phenomena. Once that's experienced in such a way that there's no longer a witnesser or a doer, there's just simply presence, transition from one moment to another without attachment or identification. It's just phenomena. That's what truly is liberating the mind from the stress and confusion. Now, whether or not we actually get to that point of total liberation, of nirvana, the path is still very much worth it. I doubt that I will experience full awakening. I don't doubt the potential of it. But it doesn't matter to me. What matters to me is really understanding how this process works to the best of my ability and training my mind as best I can to see the arising and passing away of phenomena as selfless, as impermanent and not autonomous. So the part of the discourse that I read talked about what triggers a mind object, the translation calls it. There's a particular term called nimitta, which is translated as a seed, a triggering event. Could be light striking the eye, stimulating the optic nerve. That's a triggering event. Then that stimulus travels through the visual perceptual process. And so that moment of visual experience, there's a trigger moment of light stimulating the optic nerve. Then there's a triggering moment of the mind clumping together a sense of self. It's about what the five aggregates is about. It's about what the six sense bases are about as well. This is what I'm talking about, the sense base that we call the visual process. So what we're trying to do with this practice is to observe those triggering moments with as much clarity and mental agility as possible. This is why it's important to cultivate viraga. The more the mind is activated by urgency, by craving and clinging, the harder it is to see the impermanence. But the more the mind settles down, this is back to the still forest pool again, the more the mind settles down, the more potential there is for noticing the initial moment of formation of a particular mental phenomena. On retreats, I have practiced noticing not so much visual stimuli, Well, I take that back. I was on a 3-month retreat at the Insight Meditation Society, and was walking on what's called Old Coach Road. There's a, what they call the loop, walks through this farmland where the IMS is located. But I was walking very mindfully, and an insect moved across my line of vision. And I was able to be really clearly aware of how that image caught my attention. That's the nimitta. And then I was aware of how that was identified as an ant. And then I was aware, noticing it as, realizing that that was an ant is the next nimitta moment. And then I was aware that this is what the practice is about. That moment of awareness is also a nimitta. So each moment has a little kind of forming function around it. When I, sometime in the next month or two, I'm going to be talking about paticca samuppada, which is the dependent origination doctrine. In the sense, this was just touching on that concept. What we're trying to notice as much as possible is the initial stimulation and the initial cognition relative to that stimulation with a sense of dispassion and clarity, non-attachment. And that's what fosters this process of awakening. Okay, so now I'm going to talk about the hindrances. By the way, I have more information than I've been saying, telling you all about. It's in the notes, and the notes will be posted on the website when I post the recording of this talk, probably tomorrow. So you can look to notes to get more information. The first of the five hindrances is sense desire. A Pali word for the sense desire is kamachanda. Kama is translated as enjoyment or pleasure on the occasion of a particular sense. Could be seeing something, could be hearing something, smelling something, tasting something, could be a sensation in the body. Chanda is translated as a psychological faculty that motivates action. Depending on its object, chanda can be good or bad or neutral. Chanda is actually one of what are called the chittasikas. Whenever you might be in the meditation hall, those of you who have been there, you've seen the big charts up on the wall. And chanda is one of the what's called malleable mind conditioning factors. So kama chanda basically means the initiating of a cognitive process that's flavored with pleasure. So that experience in and of itself is not a hindrance. What happens afterward, a story that the mind creates about it, that's the hindrance. There's no dukkha in a pleasant feeling. The dukkha comes to when the mind builds itself around it and craves that pleasantness to continue, to be as rewarding as it started out to be. You could consider it to be like a subjective enchantment, if you will. Now, I mentioned lobha, which is desire. But another term which is synonymous with it is tanha, which is craving. And what that really means is a kind of an unquenchable thirst. So this thirst for pleasant experience is coordinated or active, mutually reinforcing with moha, which is ignorance or delusion. So there's a sense of self that feels good, and it's kind of hardwired into us organically to want more of that and for it to continue to be pleasant. Now, one of the similes that the Buddha attributed to sense desire is that it's a form of indebtedness. Because of craving and clinging, the object of desire, the phenomena that desire is organized around and feeding off of, owns my interest in my devotion, my action. Another simile, this relates to the still forest pool, actually. Just imagine that you're looking at a container filled with water. And when the water is clear and still, I can see very clearly what's immersed into the water. When sense desire has enchanted my attention, it's like the water has been colored with an attractive dye. The mind sees the color but does not see that which is immersed into the water. Now, in terms of sense desire, our culture literally capitalizes from it. I've talked about this so many times regarding consumerism. The onset of this was about the time that I was born, right after World War II, when television first started to be so predominant and advertisement happened. Commercial interests spent literally millions of dollars studying what gets someone's attention and what gets someone to buy a particular product or service. And so that's a very sophisticated manipulation of sense desire. We're all subject to it. An author, Ann Wilson Schaaf, wrote a book that I read 30 or more years ago that really influenced me, called When Society is an Addict, which talks about this, how this wanting is woven into the fabric of what it means to be successful in this society. This is the case around the world too, but the most chronic example of that, of course, is addiction, substance addiction, but also what's called process addiction. So what causes sense desire, the proximal cause of it, is unwise attention. The Pali word for that is ayoniso manasikara. The unwise attention basically is not sufficiently stable and clear and detached in terms of investigating the triggering moment, the nimitta, and the proliferation of a self that follows that. So what we want to do is be aware of that. Of course, when you're paying attention to the sensation of breathing, whenever your attention is drawn away, there's a seed that has done that. If the seed is cooperating with desire, with pleasant feeling, then sense desire is what can occur in that regard. Now, one of the things that I really appreciate about contemporary Buddhism is how it's validated by contemporary neuroscientific research. There are parts of the brain that are activated by these triggers. The ones that are most interesting or most important are the amygdala, which is associated with feeling, and the hippocampus, which is most associated with kind of mental association. So those two neural clusters are right next to each other in the brain, and they create the proliferation around a particular seed moment. And that sends a signal to a part of the brain that is preparing either to move toward an experience, in the case with sense desire, or away from it when it's the mind is experiencing unpleasantness. So there's a lot more information that's on the notes. I don't want to get bogged down in that, but I invite you to get the notes and check that out. And see if you can get more out of that for yourself. So, antidotes for sense desire. First of all, the more you cultivate samadhipassati with mindfulness of breathing, the more stable your attention is, the pond surface is quieted, which means that you can notice those triggering events sooner rather than later. Another thing to do is to contemplate the undesirable consequences of the experience. The example that I use over and over again, because I think it's amusing but also very real, when we go on residential retreats at a place called Deer Haven, our next one will be the end of October, the people who do the cooking know that I'm diabetic, can't eat any sugar, so in the past they have very generously made brownies that are not treated with sugar. But chocolate gives me heartburn. So I'm going through there and I like chocolate. Part of me knows you shouldn't eat chocolate, get heartburn, but another part of me, oh, you know, they're so nice to me, it would be rude not to eat this. So I ate one and I got hooked. I went back and ate another. And sure enough, I had heartburn. Right? So the next time I was there and I saw that, because of the retreat, because my mind was more tempered, I was able to notice, well, you know, when you gave into this desire, and there was a desire there, it tastes really good, I'm going to get heartburn later. So I stopped. I stopped doing that because I was aware of the consequences. But you have to be able to notice and let go of that urgency, because, like I said, the first time I got it and ate it, it tasted so good. And I didn't get heartburn right away. So that, and I knew that I would somehow, but I went back and got it anyway. Well, the next time that urge came up, I didn't go there. Now, how do you deal with that urge? You notice the urge that comes with any time your attention is drawn away to a hindrance, whether it's a pleasant urge or an unpleasant urge. You see it for what it is. You notice the triggering of it, the manifestation of it in the body, in the emotions, and so forth. And you simply disregard it. So you notice and let go back to the breath. And that's another way to learn how to deal skillfully with sense desire. Next hindrance, aversion and ill will. The term which is in Pali is vyapada, translated as making bad, doing harm, desire to injure, malevolence, and ill will. It's synonymous with dosa, which is translated as anger, ill will, or evil intention. Wickedness, corruption, malice, or hatred. There's another one, another Pali term, called domanasa. It translates as mental pain, distress, dejectedness, melancholy, and grief. So these terms, you know, one of the things that Buddhist practitioners and scholars have done over the centuries is really tried to pinpoint with as much clarity and sophistication as possible the nature of these mind states. Remember, like I said, when I saw this ant move across my line of vision, I saw how this was playing out in my mind. By the way, the net realization of that, the next triggering moment, the next nimitta, was a sense of perfection. At that moment, the whole universe, it seemed like the whole universe came together just so I would have that particular understanding at that particular moment. It was a profound insight when I was walking down that old Coach Road in Massachusetts. But back to this notion about these terms that come together. You want to be able to make them ability to notice how these are happening occur as soon as possible before there gets to be momentum. One of the ways I talk about overcoming hindrances, if you're on a snow-covered hill and you create a snowball and you start to roll it down the hill and this condition of the snow is appropriate, it picks up volume and it picks up speed. And the further down the hill it goes, the faster it goes, the more mass it has, the harder it is to either stop it or redirect its flow, the way it's rolling. Same thing is true with the hindrances, or any mind state for that matter. But it happens very quickly. The sooner you can notice the formation of these different hindrances, or any thought, including, you know, the seven awakening factors, the sooner you can notice them, the more power you have, the more opportunity there is to either interrupt it or, with the awakening factors, to feed it, nurture it, encourage it. So, aversion and ill will. Aversion is a contraction or a rejection or a blocking of an unpleasant feeling. Ill will is hostile and aggressive regarding that experience. So, I mentioned how fundamental desire is. Even more basic is the desire for survival. So aversion and ill will, when something comes up that seems to be a threat, it jumps to the head of the line in terms of priorities for action. And it's very important to be able to appreciate that and understand it and work with it. The antidote for that is basically to be aware of it as soon as possible and to relax away from it. This is how I deal with it. Every time I exhale, I'm releasing and relaxing, releasing and relaxing. And that trains me to be able to do that. Now, the simile regarding aversion and ill will, first of it's like being ill with a fever. And the other is looking at the body of water, that the water is boiling. Of course, the surface is very disrupted. You can't see what's immersed in it. So fear, like I said, jumps to the head of the line. So it's very important to recognize when the mind is starting to push it away at an experience, because it can happen very quickly. I know this from my own experience. The more I've been able to cultivate samadhi paucity, the less likely I am to be fired up by aversion and ill will. So, antidotes. Notice the impermanence of the unpleasantness, particularly if you're working with physical discomfort. The physical sensations change if you are willing to investigate them. And the way the mind creates a self relative to the physical experience changes. And that's something that's been very interesting for me. Let's say I get an itch. The mind becomes really preoccupied with it and wants to scratch the itch. But if I just am willing to let go of my fight against it and really investigate it, one of the things that can happen is that the itch can be variable in its intensity. It can actually move a little bit from one spot to another on the surface of this body. And even more importantly, when my attention is drawn to something else, like going back to the breath, the power of the itch diminishes because the mind is not looped around it anymore. In terms of dealing with the aversion, ill will, that hindrance, it's sort of like if you put a microphone in front of an amplifier, a speaker rather, it creates a screeching sound. That's because there's a feedback that's going on faster and faster and faster between the pickup on the mic and the feed out on the speaker. It's enhanced by the amplifier. So you move the mic away. Well, the same thing is true with something like aversion and ill will. The more you fight with it, the more it gets powerful. But if you cultivate viraga in that regard, make it impermanent, and realize its impermanence and its impersonal nature, it simmers down. Another antidote is loving kindness. Next one. Well, those first two. You can have sense desire and delusion. You can have aversion, ill will, and delusion, or you can have delusion. So those three categories, the first two are contained in that one. The ones below are more a manifestation of delusion, the final three of the hindrances. First one is sloth and torpor. Pali term is tina, which is unwieldiness of mind states and dullness. Mida is unwieldiness of mind conditioners and sluggishness. So tina is the mind is not active. And mida, the experience, subjective experience, is heavy. It's hard to move. So there's a quality of a loss of alertness, that's the dullness part, and an inactivity, which is the sluggishness part. The simile is pond covered with algae and weeds. And the other simile is being imprisoned. Now, this one and the next one, next hindrance, restlessness and worry, are primarily about energy regulation. So what we call the sympathetic nervous system, which is activating, parasympathetic system, which is sedating. The two are supposed to be cooperating. In fact, when you're really, when samadhi paschati is very well developed, the mind is very stable and emotions are very calm and serene and the body is very physically relaxed. But there's a high degree of alertness. That means that the sympathetic and parasympathetic are operating at optimal balance. With sloth and torpor, there's too much parasympathetic activity. When the parasympathetic is operating, it decreases one's attention. It brings sedation, relaxation, just makes the body settle. With the sympathetic system, there's heightened attention, more emotional energy, more activity in the brain, fight or flight response. It also can be associated with mental restlessness, fretting. So these two systems are interacting, but when there's too much of the sympathetic, you get restlessness and worry. When there's too much of the parasympathetic, you get sloth and torpor. So what you want to do with the practice is to bring those into balance. And the way you do that is through the first three of the seven awakening factors: mindfulness, investigation of mental phenomena, and energy, which manifests as right effort. And I'll be talking more about that when I talk about the awakening factors later on, a couple weeks from now. Antidote for sloth and torpor. Make more effort to notice the breath. Look closer. That activates the sympathetic part of the process. Open your eyes. Look at a light. When you look at a light, it stimulates the pineal gland in the middle of the brain, and the pineal gland stops secreting melatonin, which is a sedating part of the parasympathetic system. Stand up. Splash water on your face. Go sit down again. Do some walking mindfully. So you want to bring more energy into the system. Probably not a good idea to try to meditate right after you've eaten. It's also a good idea to be more physically fit. And that brings more balance to the two systems. And try to avoid being overstimulated by music and so forth and so on. Next one, restlessness and worry. I talked about that already. Basically, it's an overactive sympathetic system. There's agitation, and there's a tendency of the mind to jump from one topic to another, or to ruminate on a particular line of thought, chew on it over and over and over again. So once again, the antidote for that, maintain a heightened awareness of the sensation of breathing. Notice where you're feeling tense in the body. Every time you exhale, relax. Try to avoid too much stimulation, too much caffeine or other stimulating substances, sugar, so forth. Probably a good idea to have a clear conscience. A lot of what causes worry is preoccupation with something that you said or did that was ill-considered. The last of the hindrances is skeptical doubt. The Pali term for that is visikicca, and it's translated as doubt or uncertainty or an unsettled mind. It's important to be analytical in terms of how our thought processes are playing out, but with skeptical doubt, there's a kind of internal paralysis. It's an indecisiveness. The similes that are used in terms of this with skeptical doubt, it's like being in the desert and finding a fork in the road and not knowing which to take. Another one is a pond that's so filled with mud that you can't see what's in it. There's a quality of hesitation. It may be closely associated with worry, restlessness and worry. What part of what goes on with skeptical doubt is idealizing. What I mean by that is there's a need to have the perfect answer, guaranteed outcome. Life isn't like that. One of the things that's beneficial about being really mindful and skillful is the ability to cope with changes that occur. So you make plans, and yet circumstances change in such a way that the plans can't be realized, or they have to be realized in a different way. So it's important to understand that and be able to contend with differences. So in terms of skillful means, training your mind to be alert and to investigate. Consult with people who are knowledgeable, sort of like what we're doing right now. You know, I've been studying this for about half my life now, and so I'm very knowledgeable about these concepts and these practices. Realize that part of what causes us to be doubting is a need to be perfect and feeling a sense of shame when we are imperfect, of humiliation. And part of my practice is learning how to turn humiliation into humility about my own energy, my own resources, my own skills, or the, you know, bad luck. So those are the suggestions about the five hindrances. I could talk about this for a lot longer, but we're actually running out of time tonight. But I do want to have an opportunity for any questions for clarification or comments about the hindrances from your own experience or anything you heard me say. Anybody? Julian.
Yeah, thank you, Peter. Just a short comment. So I've noticed, for example, when I'm and it's related to this, well, to aversion and this quality when there is a bit of that is samadhi capacity to be just present to that or not react to this aversion of. So, for example, I was noticing during the meditation there is a little bit of physical discomfort, and then my mind tries to just maybe avoid it, and then the way to avoid it is just maybe just rocking a bit my body or just do a little movement, and so sometimes and there is this urgency just to move as fast as to avoid the unpleasant sensation or discomfort, but sometimes when there is more like a balance or more concentration or is more aware of things, I can just stay with that without the need of this rocking or this movement. And also the analogy you mentioned about the ripples of the pond, that's that you can track them, where the ripples appear or how intense are the ripples. So these are just helpful also for the practice.
Yeah, in terms of whether to move or not with discomfort, there's a seed moment where there could be a decision to sit with the discomfort, explore what the mind does with it, and learn how to witness the impermanence of the self that is subjected to that discomfort. Alternatively, there's a seed from which can emerge a decision to rock your body a little bit, to make a slight adjustment in your posture, to perhaps enhance your ability to cultivate more samadhipassati. Both of them are workable. The idea is, how intentional are you with that? Is there an intention to cultivate more samadhi, or is there an intention to cultivate more equanimity regarding the discomfort? Being aware is the common factor there, wanting to cultivate. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it does make sense, and so for example, sometimes I notice that there is this urgency to maybe just move a little bit, and sometimes I decide to stay, and as you say, like the more I struggle with that, the more permanent it seems to be the discomfort, but otherwise it will just dissipate.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
Also, sometimes when I do I notice that I want to rock or move, I try also to, if I decide to move, I just try to move consciously, like not really, but many times I just move without, I notice the discomfort or the action after I moved. So I was immersed in the aversion, and then I realized, oh, I was having this aversion.
Right. Yeah, and that's instructive. Just being able to notice it afterwards is instructive. You realize that, you know, that's what you did. You kind of did it instinctively. Okay. But you can perhaps the next time be more thoughtful about, well, maybe this time I'll sit with it rather than just react to it. And of course, the more intentional you are about investigating the specific sensations, the trajectory of sensations, breathing in and breathing out, the more you're able to notice those seed moments instead of being just reacting. You're aware of it and you decide to not react. Any other questions or comments? Okay, the topic for next week's discussion will be the five aggregates, which is Buddhist way of discussing what we would be contemporarily called personality theory. When I was in grad school, one of the textbooks that we used was on personality theory, and one of the chapters was written by Daniel Goleman. And it was about the five aggregates as personality theory. And I was so excited. I told all of my fellow students about it, and they all like, eh, so what? They didn't care. But I was pretty excited because it validated, you know, I went to grad school because I wanted to bring Buddhism into counseling. And so that seemed to confirm my choice. All right, so let's sit for a bit as we usually do. Thank you for your practice. I wish you well. I hope that we are reasonably safe and happy till the next time we have a chance to meet.